Well, I would like us to consider this morning four words uttered by Jesus. He utters them in John chapter 11, verse 25, although that passage is not, of course, an account of the Easter Sunday morning event. You'll immediately appreciate the relevance of this utterance that Jesus makes here. And here it is then, John 11, 25, I am the resurrection. I am the resurrection. That is what Jesus says there. And what we're going to do is look at the four words individually, exploring the particular contribution which each makes. But we're not going to do so in the natural order, I am the resurrection. Rather, we're going to proceed in almost exactly the reverse order with just one small deviation. And so without further ado then, let's get stuck in and consider first of all the word resurrection. Resurrection. It's not a word that's used very often, is it, in ordinary everyday conversation. Some words are versatile, aren't they? They can be used in lots of ways, all very different from each other. You think of the word draw, D-R-A-W, and all the different kinds of drawing that you can do. You can draw a picture. You can draw a pair of curtains. You can draw some game or other against an evenly matched rival. You can draw money from the bank. You can draw a carriage with a horse. You can draw someone aside for a quick word. You can draw criticism for expressing a controversial opinion. You can draw a particular opponent in the next round of a competition. You can draw a hasty conclusion about something. You can draw someone's attention to something. You can draw a deep breath. You can draw a distinction or a comparison between two things. You can draw a blank when asked to recall something. And we could go on probably with further uses of the word draw. It's a hugely versatile word, and so it gets used often. Other words, however, are not versatile. They only have one very specific meaning. The other day, I came across the word archaeoseismology. And it's like that then. It's not an endlessly bendable and malleable term, the way that draw is. It refers to the study of ancient earthquakes by means of archaeological finds. And unless then you're talking about that, you're not really going to use that word. And resurrection, I suppose, is in the same category. It's a word that has one very specific meaning. And we must ask the question then this morning, well, what is that one very specific meaning? Well, resurrection doesn't simply denote life after death. Life after death moves roughly in the right direction, but nonetheless, as a definition of resurrection, it's wholly inadequate. Now, a proper definition of resurrection must include two aspects. Number one, it's the raising of a dead body to life. And number two, it's the raising of a dead body to a life that's new and enhanced and immortal, a permanent, irreversible, unassailable kind of physical existence. I hope you can see then that resurrection is a very bold and radical concept. I mean, the idea of life after death, you'll find that in all sorts of different places, different cultural traditions, different religions, different streams of thoughts. But pretty much always, there's this sense, unspoken yet unmistakable, that future afterlife, whatever form it may take, it's the poor relation. That is to say, this life is the real thing, where we have bodies and can climb mountains and scuba dive and eat steak and sit beside roaring fires. That future life is a much more shadowy, dreamy kind of existence, certainly better than nothing, certainly a consolation in the face of death, but lacking the vitality and the solidity of this life. Everything is greyer somehow, everything is slower, everything is dimmer, everything is sleepier. That's the impression that you always get. But that's not how it is in the biblical outlook. Because the biblical outlook centers on this concept of resurrection, I'm saying. And that means it's the reverse of what you get with all those other worldviews. It's this life that's the poor relation. It's this life that's the shadowy, dreamy existence. It's this life that lacks vitality and solidity. The movement isn't from the real to the less real, it's from the less real to the real. C.S. Lewis reflected much on this. In one of his letters, he put it this way. He wrote, "We are a seed patiently waiting in the earth, waiting to come up a flower in the gardener's good time, up into the real world, the real waking. I suppose that our whole present life, looked back on from there, will seem only a drowsy half-waking. We are here in the land of dreams, but cockcrow is coming." Or you may think of the way in which he presents a similar idea by means of fiction in his book, The Last Battle. There, Narnia comes to an end. Aslan dismantles it before then ushering all the Narnians who are on his side into a new world. And as they enter then and proceed further and further into it, they can't quite work out what's going on. This place, it's grander and more sublime than anything they've ever experienced before, and yet at the same time, there's a familiarity about it. Until eventually one of the characters really hits the nail on the head and gets to the nub of the matter and says this, "The reason why we love the old Narnia is that it sometimes looked a little like this." And those who will participate in the future life that's held out in the Bible will feel something like that. Not, "Oh well, we've lost forever now the best experiences of our old lives, but at least this afterlife is a good second best." Rather, the reason we love those best experiences of our old lives is that they sometimes looked a little like this. That's what they'll say. I'm saying the concept of resurrection makes the biblical outlook very distinctive. It means the next life, far from being a shriveling, is a graduation, a flowering, a coming into its own. Resurrection, let's work backwards. The resurrection. The resurrection. In the springtime of last year, along the east coast of the United States, trillions of cicadas came out of the ground in order to spend a few weeks feeding, mating, and dying. And the mass emergence then of these little insects attracted attention all over the world. Why did it? Well, because this phenomenon only occurs every 17 years. Cicadas operate on this strange timetable that seems to baffle all the scientists. And you see, it's not simply then that each individual cicada has its own 17-year cycle, meaning that this one surfaces in 2019 and this one surfaces in 2020 and so on. Of course, that wouldn't work in terms of them being able to mate with each other, and so they wouldn't be able to maintain their numbers. No, across the entire species, there's this shared 17-year cycle. It's all or nothing with cicadas. And so 2005, nothing. 2006, nothing. 2007, nothing. And so on and so on. Nothing, 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 nothing. Until suddenly 2021, all of them come out. Which, of course, makes the event stunningly dramatic. All of a sudden, gardens and woodlands along the eastern coast teem with all these things, the sight of them and the sound of them everywhere. It's a veritable explosion of cicadas. And this business of resurrection, then, that I've just been talking about, there's a similar kind of drama associated with it. Because, you see, it happens as a oneer. That's the significance of this word, the. The Bible doesn't talk about resurrections, plural, resurrections that are chronologically scattered. No, it talks about the resurrection. Jesus, you remember, is in a conversation here. He's in a conversation with this woman called Martha. And actually, Martha, too, in her remarks immediately preceding the words of Jesus that we're looking at, mentions the resurrection. And she elaborates the resurrection on the last day. That is the day when history ends. Then it is. Then, simultaneously, millions of human beings will come out of the ground. And in many ways, this coming out of the ground will be very different from that of the cicadas. It won't be the emergence of grubby little insects. On the contrary, each participant in the resurrection will, in C.S. Lewis's words, be such a creature as if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship. But what it has in common with the cicada phenomenon is the drama of a mass event, the concentrated nature of the thing. Like in the springtime of last year there in the States, but of course on a far greater scale still, there will be this sudden explosion from nowhere of life and noise and activity, all these people together at the same time receiving that new enhanced bodily life that we've been talking about. I mean, God is the master of subtle processes, isn't he? You think of the way that dawn unfolds every morning, from the first crack in the eastern sky to the point where everything is fully bathed in light. And it happens fairly rapidly, and yet in such a way, nonetheless, that there are no sudden jolts, are there? Just this quiet, seamless advance of daylight. An incoming tide at the beach is like that too. Again, it's pretty quick, really, but each wave just gains a little ground, imperceptibly. Until before you know it, your bucket and spade, which were safely on the sand, are floating off toward the horizon. And God designed these features, then, of our world. He's the master of these subtle processes, but he's not limited to subtle processes. He also has it in his repertoire to pull off something epic. He designed that emergence of the cicadas every 17th year. And he is going to pull off something epic on an unprecedented and literally unimaginable scale at the end of time. This will be the mother of all events. I said we don't really use the word archaeoseismology, but we do use the word seismic, don't we, sometimes? And we talk about those seismic events which punctuate history. And we're not using it literally, we're using it metaphorically. We're not usually talking about literal earthquakes. Well, this event will be immeasurably more seismic than anything you've ever studied in any history lesson at school. The resurrection, concentrated, simultaneous, together, in a oneer. What an event that will be. What a prospect. The resurrection. But let's move backwards further, and this is where we deviate slightly, and we go to the word I, the resurrection. I, the resurrection. So this is the shortest, and yet the most important of the words in this little phrase. And it's a staggering claim. This is Jesus speaking, of course. And he's saying then that this seismic event that we have just been talking about, this mind-blowing, earth-shattering event, this mass raising of the dead on the last day, it all centers on him. It's crucial that we're clear on this, because surely what we've been saying in these last few minutes should leave us with one burning question in our minds, which is this: how does one come to participate in the resurrection? How do we ensure that we are among those raised on the last day? Well, if the resurrection centers on Jesus, then the answer to that question must have to do with him. So what exactly does he mean then? I, the resurrection. Well, answering that question involves jumping forward in this Gospel of John, jumping forward above all else to that moment at the end of the Gospel. You don't actually have to turn there because you know it anyway. But that moment at the end of the Gospel that we, of course, are particularly celebrating today, that Sunday morning. Jesus had died on the Friday afternoon. He had been buried in a new tomb somewhere fairly near to the execution site. Saturday had passed quietly, and for those close to him, mournfully. But then at some point, early on the Sunday morning, the quietness of that scene was suddenly shattered. The stone covering the tomb's entrance was supernaturally removed, and out of the darkness and coldness and deadness of that cave came Jesus, the same Jesus, the same body that had hours before been brutally slaughtered. But no longer was the old mortal life draining pathetically out of him. Now resurrection life was surging powerfully through him. Supremely, if we're going to understand Jesus' words here in John 11:25, we have to jump forward to that moment. But also to another bit of John's Gospel. There's another bit of John's Gospel that comes between this passage we're looking at and the account of Jesus' resurrection on Easter Sunday morning. Another part that's relevant here. It's John chapter 15. There, Jesus paints this fascinating illustration involving a tree and branches. He's the tree, he says. And his people, believers, Christians, are branches, the branches of the tree. Imagine walking along through the countryside and you idly pick up a stick and it's just an old, dead, rotten, gnarled, unattractive looking stick. And as you walk along holding this stick, you come in your walk to a tree standing there near you that's just bursting with life. It's laden with fruits. Such a vibrant, life-filled tree. And imagine then that you could take that old, dead, rotten stick that you're holding and you could somehow kind of wedge it into that tree and you could lodge it in there. And you could hammer it into that tree so effectively that that stick would start to participate in the life of that tree. And it would start to burst with petals and with green and with fruits. Of course, it's impossible, isn't it? You couldn't possibly do that. But the point then of Jesus' illustration in John 15 is that something like that is exactly what happens when a person becomes a Christian. That person is that old, rotten, dirty, dead stick. But in that moment, that person is attached to Jesus, plugged in to the tree. This tree that's bursting with life, this risen Jesus, with resurrection surging through him. And what is impossible then in the botanical realm happens in this realm. And all that resurrection that's surging through Jesus, it surges into that person, that dirty old stick that has been plugged into him. It surges into that person. So that that person comes to participate in this resurrection that we've been talking about this morning. That's the answer to the question. How do I come to participate in this? The answer is by becoming a believer in Jesus Christ, by becoming a follower, a disciple of his. And in that moment, being plugged in to the risen one. So that all that resurrection that's in him, swirling around him, pulsating through him, it surges into you and you cannot but participate on that day in that event. Have you done that? Have you trusted in Jesus Christ? Are you one of those rotten old branches lying on the forest floor that has been wedged into the tree that's so bursting with life? The one that came out of that grave on Easter Sunday morning. Jesus, have you been joined? Have you been welded? Have you been riveted to him? Well, we've got one more word. And it's another short one. It's the word am. I am the resurrection. And perhaps then you've sensed over these last couple of minutes when I've been talking about that, you've sensed a certain oddness here. You become a Christian, I've said, And in that moment, you're like that branch, that stick, you're plugged into Jesus, who is so full of resurrection. And yet, it's only then in the distant future that you participate in this event that we've been talking about this morning. And there seems to be this odd lag then, this odd time lag between becoming a Christian and being plugged into the one so full of resurrection, but actually experiencing resurrection yourself. And yet Jesus' tense here, his grammatical tense, is I am the resurrection. Not I will be the resurrection, but I am the resurrection. Why? Well, because there is a very real and a very important sense in which when you believe in Jesus, you are plugged in to him, you are that stick joined to the tree bursting with life, and immediately resurrection energy surges from him and into you. Not yet doing anything to your body, that's pretty obvious. We're a bunch of Christians here this morning and our bodies don't look particularly resurrected because they haven't been, as we've said. It will only happen on the last day. It doesn't yet do anything to our bodies, but it surges into us and through us nonetheless. In what sense then? Well, in this sense, enabling a new kind of life. Enabling a new kind of life. Do you ever look at yourself in the mirror, metaphorically speaking? Look at your life. Look at your patterns of thought. Look at your preoccupations. Look at your behavior. Look at the words that you speak, even to those who are closest to you and who you profess to love. And do you just loathe so much of it? There's so much there that's ugly. And you've tried perhaps from time to time to throw it off and you can't throw it off. It just keeps coming back like a kind of grip that holds you so tightly. The Bible talks about that. The Apostle Paul uses a very, very strong word to describe it. A word that we use with distaste and understandably so today, slavery. Paul talks about us being slaves to sin, not just a few of us, not just Vladimir Putin and his ilk, but all of us, we're born slaves to sin. We can't not sin. We can do some good things as well, but we can't not sin. We can't resist this temptation to be ugly in our thoughts, in our words, in our actions. And so it's slavery. The Bible also, though, describes it as a kind of death. We're kind of born dead, not biologically, but morally, because we just keep on messing up and being ugly in the way that we live. But you see, what happens then when that stick is joined to the tree that's bursting with life, when that human being is joined to the risen, the resurrection Jesus, is that resurrection energy immediately surges into that person, enabling them to at last start to get the better of all that ugliness. And it still involves a fight, and it's a process over time, but the ability, the possibility is there now. That person can change. That person can be different. That person can be new. That person is new. There's energy now flowing from the one who came out of the grave on Easter Sunday morning into that little person in Newcastle. And that's a wonderful thing. And if you're not a Christian, then I say to you this morning, you don't have to carry on being a slave. You don't have to carry on being in the grip of your vices. But you can be joined, plugged into Jesus Christ and become now already a participant in resurrection energy as you look forward to the day of the resurrection, when you will take your place alongside millions of others, your very body being restored to glorious life. Come and be plugged into Jesus Christ. Amen.